A great song there, Spirit of the Anzacs by Lee Kernaghan and friends, including Shannon Knoll and quite a few other legends of the Australian music scene. All right, well, Graeme Kemlow, that'd be you, introduces a special story in recognition of Anzac Day, one of the most important national days of remembrance in Australian military history. We focus on one extraordinary soldier, Brian Walpole, who was not an Anzac, however, bravely waged his war behind Japanese lines with a small band of Iban headhunters during the occupation of Sarawak from 1943 to 1945. He wrote a gripping account of this in a book called My War, Life is for Living, with journalist David Lavelle, detailing his life as a member of Australia's elite Z Special Unit.
Well, David Lavelle, welcome to Travel Writers Radio. Thank you very, very much for agreeing to come on the show today and talk about Brian Walpole on this Anzac Day. How did you How did you come to meet Brian, David?
Well, I met Brian, it would have been in June of 2003 when I was working for the Australians at War Film Archive, and we were filming a whole range of World War II veterans to basically record their memories for posterity and also for the use of filmmakers. All of the interviews, which were very detailed, were filmed in front of green screen so filmmakers could superimpose any visuals they wanted behind the interview subject. And Brian was one of them. When we were setting up the camera gear in his flat, he asked if either of us, it was a two-person team, knew any literary agents. And well, I did know a literary agent. So he went on to say that he had this manuscript about his war experiences and he was wanting to send it to a literary agent. So I was quite happy to help him. So I passed it on for him and I ended up joining the project afterwards as the editor and collaborator with him because it needed a bit of work to knock it into publishable shape. It was a fascinating story, and he had a great way with words and quite a character, which really showed through in the writing. So it was a matter of trimming it down and keeping his voice. And so, yeah, I got to know him working on that and going into and helping him retell his life story so he could produce a book of his very, very unusual war experience.
Yeah, he's been described variously as swashbuckling, as a bit of a boy's own adventurer. Someone else suggested that he was a gorilla in the sense of the GUE Rilla, not the other one. But he was a bit of a loner, wasn't he?
Because a lot of the campaigns that he was doing were in very small groups, and in some instances, he was the only Australian soldier in his group. He was working with headhunters behind enemy lines in Sarawak, and in some cases, he was literally the only Australian soldier. It was him and a dozen or so Iban or Sea Dayak headhunting warriors that were helping him. And so he had very few colleagues. And so he had a different war experience, I suppose, to a lot of soldiers who bonded very strongly with a unit of men that they went through the war with. And he really didn't have that experience. He served in two theatres of war. He was in New Guinea as a commando, and his independent company, as the Australian commandos were called, suffered very heavy casualties, and a lot of his friends there didn't come back. And then afterwards, he found himself in Z Special Unit, which was the very secretive undercover unit, and he had very few Australian colleagues in that, as I was saying. And so he was his war was very different from a lot of people. And he didn't speak about it for a long time afterwards, too. He really had to be coaxed, I think, to do his book. He eventually became very enthusiastic about it, but I think I wasn't there when he started to write it, but I understood he did it at the urging of younger friends, much younger friends of recent years who got a few stories out of him, and they started urging him to put it down on paper. And otherwise it may have all been lost.
Oh, look, he certainly is a great storyteller, and I can't tell whether there's any embellishment in what he did. Do you think there was, or did he genuinely have these experiences?
Well, one thing I do know is that when I was doing the manuscript, everything that I could check, checked out.
Right.
There's a lot that can't be checked, but I never caught him out with a fabrication.
Hmm. No, I think you're right.
There were things which I suppose he could have researched later, but then there's other things that he couldn't, which then when you look at certain consequences and results, you think, well, it is quite plausible that that led to that. But also his memories, they didn't look researched either. Like, they were correct, but sometimes they might be a little off-kilter, like someone who was actually there remembering back might be, rather than someone that's looked it up in a war book. And just talking to him, I did not ever feel I was in the presence of a fantasist or someone who thought the truth wasn't important, that a good story was better than the truth. He didn't really have that demeanour.
Mm.
He didn't strike me as someone like that, but maybe there was, I don't know, maybe over time there was a few more Japanese killed than really were, or there was a few more women than he went out with or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
But basically it all checked out and was very, very believable.
Yeah. Now, we're actually, sadly, we're talking about him in the past, because he did die at, I think, the age of 86 in 2009.
Yeah, 2009. Yeah,
but he led a great life. And it's interesting, his book is probably well named, My War, Life is for Living. He certainly had life about him, didn't he?
Yes, and life is for living is his little catchphrase.
Yeah.
He would use it in conversation as well, and it's dotted throughout his book.
Yes.
I think in his case it probably had a lot of meanings, and one of them would be, you know, he wasn't someone to knock back an adventure, you know. If he could take the extreme option, I think he would for the hell of it.
Now, before the war, David, I saw a photo of him all dressed up in a suit. He looked $1 million. He was in Toorak Road, South Yarra. I've got a feeling he was in real estate.
I think he got into real estate after the war.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, because he was only very young. I think he was only 17 when the war broke out.
Right.
He was born in 1922. He finished school early. I think he did his leaving certificate when he was younger than most. I think he was fast-tracked because he was smart.
Hmm.
And he reckoned that he was going to study medicine, but he was too young to enroll in the university. So, and his father worked in a bank, and I think his idea was he'd get a job in a bank until he could enroll in university and do medicine.
Yeah.
And the war broke out. So I don't think he ever actually started the bank job.
So he was sent to New Guinea, what, at about 18 or something?
Yeah, something like that. He volunteered for the independent companies.
Right.
He didn't. He was too young to enlist at the outset of the war, but by about 1942, I think he enlisted very young in an independent company, and he passed all of the physical tests because they were more rigorous, I think, than the regular army. And in fact, he became an instructor only a couple of months after he enlisted.
Mm, okay.
Because they were trying to train up and get a lot of men and fill the independent companies quickly to do this guerrilla-type fighting in New Guinea. And the top ones in the training were offered instructor jobs to try and get other people through. So he didn't actually have to fight. He could have stayed in Australia and spent the war as an instructor.
Yeah, well, that's
but he didn't. And what he wanted to go to New Guinea, so he actually got himself demoted so he could join an independent company.
Oh,
they wouldn't take him at rank. I think he was I can't remember what rank he was, but he had to revert to private to get into an independent company to fight, and he did because he didn't want to spend the war as an instructor.
Oh, that's fascinating. I noticed he wore khaki sort of overalls. He didn't appear to have any insignia, or maybe there was a parachute badge or something. But literally, he was almost in civvies, but they were khaki.
It could be a photo that you're thinking when he was training with Zed Special Unit.
Right.
And it mightn't have been full uniform.
Ah, well, okay.
The Zed Special Unit, they had training in remote locations, including Fraser Island in Queensland.
Yes.
And they'd go there and they'd just drop them in some part of the island and they have to live off the land. They have quite extreme training. But he told me that as arduous as his work in Borneo was, and all the Z unit, he said it was nowhere near as tough as New Guinea, and having survived his New Guinea experience, he was well placed to put up with Borneo. He said it was, he said conditions were nowhere near as tough in the jungle in Borneo as they were in New Guinea.
That's interesting. He contracted malaria up in New Guinea, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. Yeah, and he was ruled medically unfit. I think he somehow got himself into a position where he enlisted in the Air Force, right, even though he was medically unfit for the Army.
Right.
He got himself, I don't know how he spun it, but he while he was medically unfit for the Army, he managed to get into the Air Force.
And that's how he got back,
And then, yeah, I'm a bit hazy on that story, but then Zed Special Unit got in touch with him because they were looking for people with his sort of experience. And I think they offered to overturn his medical discharge or unfitness. Yeah, he suffered from malaria. I don't think he got full-blown malaria until he came back on leave in Melbourne.
Okay.
But he was hospitalised with malaria for quite a long time.
Yes, he writes about being out at Heidelberg Repat.
Yeah, he spent a long time recovering. And
dating all the nurses, maybe.
Yeah. He's got quite a few yarns of partying on with the female population.
Oh. David, I'm enjoying our chat. I want to talk about how he gets to Kuching, because it's quite remarkable, the story he told me his arrival in Kuching. Now, David, in my conversations with Brian, he tells me about his exercise in the Rajang River in Sarawak, which is the largest river in the state. I believe it runs parallel to the Kuching, the river in Kuching. And his idea was he had to sweep down this river and get rid of all the Japanese all the way down to the South China Sea. Now, did he talk to you about this special one-man submarine?
Yes, the Sleeping Beauty, I think it was called.
Right.
I don't think he ever actually used it in action. I don't know if anybody did.
He tells me he put a limpet, or not a limpet, some plastic explosive on a vessel.
Oh, okay. He might have.
In one of the harbours.
I can't recall that story.
And then the other one was that he was out on this thing. But now, you have to paint the picture. Apparently, it had some sort of an aluminium frame with covered in canvas. It had some buoyancy via some tanks, and he had to wear a wetsuit and had a sort of a snorkel. So he was three quarters underwater himself, and it putted along on a couple of motorcycle batteries. He tells me that he was tooting around this harbour and a semaphore light came upon him, and they started to flash him to identify himself. And he realised it was the Americans, and so he told them with his torch to go forth and multiply. And they then realised that they were dealing with an Australian. Now, I don't know how true that story is, but it sort of struck me as interesting. He obviously wasn't having...
I think there's a similar story like of... I think when they're on a boat, when they're on their way to a mission and they got challenged by another ship and they flashed a message like that.
Oh, okay.
In Morse code, I think.
Oh, well, maybe I'm mixing a couple of stories up. And that vessel you're talking about, I think, was a Craik vessel. They were made here in Port Melbourne. They're like a Chinese junk, and they were deliberately meant to look like one. But instead of cargo on the deck, those boxes hid machine guns and things, I believe.
I think when the 9th Division landed in Labuan, Zed Special Unit was sent to kidnap a Japanese Kempeitai officer, and he was part of that mission. It was about a week after Labuan, I think, and they went on that vessel to do that kidnapping mission, which was a successful mission, I think. And that was before the operation that ended up in Kuching, which was a bigger one. It was called Semet 3.
Yeah, I read about that. I didn't realise the name of it.
Yeah, apparently it means ant.
Now, but what we do know and what's documented in the war records is that he set out down the Rajang River, and I don't know when, but he gathered around him this group of sea dyaks or Iban, and he had one of them was a favourite of his, and he talks about him quite a bit, and he would say how excited they got when he would suggest to them it's time to go headhunting. Did he retell you that story?
Yes, it was a big part of the operation. The Semit operation was to recruit the Iban headhunters to help the Allied soldiers with their great knowledge of the jungle and their jungle fighting abilities. The Iban, of course, were persecuted by the Japanese terribly. You know, there was terrible atrocities and cruelties happening. So the idea was to harness that force in the country that had a very strong anti-Japanese sentiment and also great expertise in jungle fighting.
Right.
But the thing is, they were headhunters. So to get their undivided cooperation, they had to be allowed to take the heads of their conquests. So part of the Semit operation involved the Australian Z Special Unit paying the headhunters bounties for every Japanese head they took, which was the result of every ambush and that the Iban helped the team with. So right. There were groups of headhunters that joined with Brian and the other couple of Australian Z men that were there, and they'd help them with the ambushes. And then after an ambush had taken place, the headhunters would then behead the corpses, and later on the heads were counted, and one straight settlement dollar was paid to them for each head that they took.
Right. Brian told me occasionally they'd bring a Chinese head by mistake and he'd have to sort of push that to one side and say, I can't pay you for that one.
Yeah, sometimes they did try it on. And I think there was a bit of a problem with a few non-Japanese heads being offered.
Collateral damages, they would say,
yeah,
in the US.
So, yes.
He comes down the Rajung River walking on one side. I don't know whether he ever crossed this river. It's a pretty large river from what I can see of it on Google Earth and everything. But along the way, he told me that he had a family of orangutan, and, of course, this area is one of the last remaining areas for the orang. And the family of orangutan, four of them, mum and dad and two chimps, if that's the right word for a baby orang, they followed him along, and he used to leave his chocolate ration on the side of the path for them. And they didn't really gauge closely, but he was able to stop up the path easily close enough to observe what was going on. But he was a bit careful because the young ones would be protected fiercely by the parents, of course. Did you hear that story?
Yes, and that's one aspect of Brian that I think is very interesting and appealing. He took a genuine interest in the environment there and the jungle and everything about it. He was interested in what was there, and he had great affection for the Iban people too. He was remarkably, as I think one reviewer of the book said, he seems to be remarkably free of colonial prejudices of his time, and he was. And just to hear him talk, he took the trouble to learn as much as he could of their language.
Yes.
Before he went. So, and I think he may have been just about the only one there who could converse with them and strike up a rapport with them.
Right.
It was something he couldn't fake, you know, like he enjoyed their company and they enjoyed his company.
Yeah.
They assumed he was a headhunter. I mean, they ended up thinking that Australians were headhunters.
Graham Kemlow was speaking with journalist David Lavelle about Zed Special Forces soldier Brian Walpole and his book, My War, Life is for Living. Graham spent a week in Sarawak with Brian Walpole, who died not long before we started Travel Writers Radio a decade ago. So we don't have a recording of Brian, but his book is a great read if you can find it. It was published by ABC Books.
This is the Travel Writers Show on J Air 88 FM in Melbourne.